Hello, you're listening to episode 6 of the Words of the Wise podcast, hosted by me, Lexi Maynard. If this happens to be your first time listening to us, make sure to hit the subscribe button on here, or you can find us on Instagram at Words of the Wise podcast, or on Twitter at Words of W podcast if you are wanting to find out more about our mission and what we're about. Today, my guest is the man who many know as Coach Bill Lynch. But to me and his 16 other grandkids, he is Papa Bill. For sentimental reasons, I wanted to interview him outside overlooking Heritage Lake, his favorite place in the world. Although boats went by, causing the audio to not be the best at times, try to look past that as the setting truly captures what the average everyday looks like for the retired football coach. Without further ado, here is episode 6, Bill Lynch.
Hello, I'm Bill Lynch. I am 66 years old. I was born on June 12, 1954, at St. Vincent's Hospital in Indianapolis, Indiana.
And can you tell me where we are today?
We are at Heritage Lake, which is in Coatesville, Indiana.
And why do you love the lake so much? Especially Mimi says it's your favorite place to be.
Well, it probably goes back to when I was a kid. My parents had a lake house at Clear Lake, way up in the northeast corner of the state of Indiana. And I remember as a kid, it was a vacation place, but it was a lot of fun and a lot of great memories. And Linda and I both really enjoyed lake life, and we used to vacation at times at the lakes, and then we kind of fell into it. When I came over to coach at DePaul in 2004, you know, we were looking for something a little bit different. We had sold our house in Muncie and really had never heard of Heritage Lake. Linda found it and said she came out and narrowed it down to a few places. They brought me out. We decided to buy it, and it was a great decision because we moved a year later to Bloomington and then to Indianapolis. But we kept the lake the whole time. Family liked it, and we did, and didn't know that go full circle and be back here living full time like we did in, I guess it was 2011, 12, somewhere in there.
Yeah, but that's why I'm glad that we're out here doing the interview here at Heritage Lake, because it is such a special place for you. I know I love the lake. So you were born in Indianapolis. What was Indianapolis like then compared to now?
Oh, it was a much smaller city than it is now, but much of the Broaderville area. And the Broaderville area is somewhat different now than it was grew up. Went downtown for certain things, but the downtown was much smaller. In fact, I go downtown now and I hardly recognize where I'm at. There was a time when I was a kid, I used to hitchhike to go downtown or take the city bus to go downtown. It has changed through the years, and the suburbs have changed the greater Indianapolis area quite a bit.
Yeah. So let's talk about your parents. What were they like?
Well, my father was about 6 or 7 years older than my mother, and you know, he was born and raised in Purdue, Indiana, up north of Kokomo. Went to Purdue, was an engineering student, but he was one that, you know, got caught up in World War II, and he was on the beaches of Normandy, I believe, in 1944. So he spent 3 or 4 years over in Europe during World War II. When he came back, is when he met my mother, because he had, again, grown up in Peru, went to Purdue, moved to Indianapolis, got a job, and started his career. And that's where he met my mother. And I believe they got married in 1949. So they were great people. Mother, you know, she was, in those days, you know, quite often the mother didn't work. Raised the four of us, and Dad was, you know, he was working, so there are a lot of things that spent a lot of time with my mother, learned a lot from her. She was, for me, I was real interested in athletics, those things, and she was very comfortable with that because she had four brothers of her own that were all athletes, and a couple of them, you know, played college athletics themselves, so she understood all that, so she made the sacrifices, you know, you got to make to get me to all the practices and all the different things. My dad was an engineer, but most my early years, his office was at home. First place we lived, down in the basement, he had his office because it was kind of a one-man gang there. He was a structural engineer and had worked with a bigger firm and wanted to have his own business, and so he moved it there. And then when we moved a few years later, he had an office, built a house that we moved to up by Broaderville Park, and made sure he had his own office there. So it was really, you know, as a kid, in the summertime, you got to see him a lot. you know, obviously he was working or he might be out at a site or something. But he was very, very supportive of all the kids. They were great parents, really supportive, and were all the way through until they passed away.
What would you say is your greatest childhood memory?
Had a lot of fun as kids. My dad's side of the family, he was the only one that married. There were three boys, and his two older brothers never married, so on that side of the family, we didn't have cousins. But on my mother's side of the family, it was a big family, similar to yours, you know, with a lot of cousins about the same age, and you know, spent a lot of time with them, and had some great times. I would say, you know, I got involved with athletics at an early age, and so I think back to some of those, whether it was Little League baseball or CYO basketball, CYO football, those kind of things. But we were fortunate. You know, we had a good childhood, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, you went to Chatard.
Right.
What year did you graduate?
I graduated in 1972.
And you played football, basketball, track in high school, correct?
Yep.
What would you say was your favorite sport during that time? Was it football or...
You know, it was dead even between football and basketball. A lot of guys nowadays can still play two sports or three sports, but I really did enjoy all of it. Football, probably, when I got to high school, football changes a little bit more from elementary school, junior high football, to high school football. We were undefeated my senior year, and that was before they had playoffs in the state of Indiana. Never got to find out how far we would have gone. He really made football fun. So football became a sport that rivaled basketball. I think when I was younger, we probably didn't get more of a basketball player. So they, you know, they were even. I didn't get involved on track really until my senior year. But that was kind of, I knew where I was going to college, and I had some buddies on the track team, and they asked me to come out. Ended up having a little success, but
yeah.
it was fun.
Yeah, you went to the state, right?
No, interesting story. I had to finish in the top four at the regional to get to the state final. I finished fourth, so I thought I was going to the state finals, but Phil Eskew, this is an interesting story too, who is the commissioner of the IHSA, he was on the track that day helping judge, and he came up to me and said, "Son, you're disqualified." What I had done is I had cut a guy off by moving out on the track, and it was the first year I ever ran track. I didn't know that was a rule. So anyway, I got disqualified by the commissioner of the IHSA, Phil Eskew. Little did we know, grandmother, you know, Linda, had four children, and all four of them, Phil Eskew's son, delivered the children.
Really?
Yeah, he was our doctor, came a great friend, and yeah, his dad was the one that, and he was right, I was wrong, I didn't even know that it was illegal to move out on the track. So that was how my high school career ended, by being disqualified in the regional track meet. Anyway, I look back at it and I can laugh now.
So when did you start getting recruited? And I mean, we were looking at the letters inside. You got recruited by a bunch of different people. So when did that recruiting process start, and how is it different compared to the recruiting process now?
Well, it was a lot different because it didn't start as early. You know, now in recruiting, you really start watching a prospect at the end of their sophomore year. And I probably didn't start getting letters or phone calls until midway through my senior year, which again is much different. So many of the athletes now, they make their decision prior to their senior year. I didn't make mine until after the basketball season my senior year. You know, I got a little bit of recruiting letters and from some of the major schools, and I knew I wasn't a major college athlete. I wasn't big enough. I weighed probably 155 pounds, and you know, as a kid you think, boy, you get a chance to play in the Big Ten or whatever, but I was realistic enough, and really my coaches were really honest with me that, hey, you got to look at probably that next level. So really it came down to Butler and Ball State, and Ball State at the time was at a level not what they are now. You know, now they're a major Division I program, where at that time, really, it was kind of major college and small college was kind of how they classed. And they were a little bit on the bubble, because they, for years, had competed in the same conference that Butler played in, the Indiana Collegiate Conference. But then they grew and got bigger. And so, anyway, they were what would be considered a major college. So I went up and visited there, and one of the things I really wanted to do, though, I really wanted to play football and basketball. And basketball, it was interesting, because at Ball State, the football coach offered me a scholarship, but I never got a chance to talk to the basketball coach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was smart enough, you know, he said, yeah, you can play basketball, but I was smart enough to know if the basketball coach isn't talking to me, that I'm not one of his top recruits.
Yeah.
Where at Butler, where I ended up going, both the football coach and the basketball came to my house, say that we want you. In fact, my scholarship, as it turned out, was a split scholarship. Half of it was football and half of it was basketball. So they made a real commitment.
A lot of your family went to Butler.
Yeah, on my mother's side of the family, I had four uncles. It's interesting. Two of them went to Notre Dame. Notre Dame graduates, athletics at Notre Dame. They were high school athletes. And the two went to Butler. And the two that went to Butler played both football and basketball.
Really?
Which is what I ended up doing. So there was a real family connection there. Plus, it was local. It was in town. You know, I remember this. My dad asked me at one point, he said, what do you think you want to do? You know, what school are you going to choose?
Yeah.
And I said... it'd be Butler without a doubt, but it's only 15 minutes away from home. I want to get away. I remember he looked at me and said, well, you've made your decision then. And he kind of walked out of the room. And I thought, what does he mean by that? Does that mean he thinks that I'm going to go away from home or stay? He knew all along that's where I was going to go. So it ended up being a really easy decision, a really good decision too. Butler was a great place to go and opened up a lot of doors for what I wanted to do later on.
And
obviously, you know, a lot of friends.
You got to play both football and basketball there. What would you say was your greatest memory or story for playing college athletics?
You know, I think that as much as anything, it's the memories of the guys you played with. The basketball, we had some really big wins, and we had some good teams, but we probably didn't win at the same level that we did in football. But George Theofanis was the basketball coach and was a really nice man and good person, and you know, some great friend Barry Collier, who was a very, very successful head basketball coach there and now the athletic director. We were teammates and fraternity brothers, and so I really enjoyed, you know, playing basketball. Football probably had a little bit more success. Bill Sylvester, it's interesting, he was the head football coach and the athletic director, and at that point I'd say loved them both.
Larry Bird was attending Indiana State playing for them. You played against him, correct?
Yes. Sure did. Played against him twice. And I'll never forget the Larry Bird story is well documented, that he graduated from small high school in southern Indiana, went to IU, left IU really before he ever played a game, went back home, worked on a garbage truck, and then he ended up going to Indiana State. So he was a forgotten guy. But we played him early in the year as my senior year, and we played him over at Indiana State. And I remember the scouting report, coach was talking about this Larry Bird, he was an Indiana All-Star, he went to IU. Yeah. I swear, we're over there in Terre Haute. First time down the court, I'm not guarding Larry Bird, he's 6'9", but I got switched off on him, like, you know, happened. And I remember a shot went up, and I went to block him out, and I thought I had good position. And the next thing I know, I looked up and I saw his big arm come over the top of me. He grabbed the ball and slammed it so hard, it hit the ground, came up, hit me in the chin. I bit my tongue, and I turned around, I saw 33 running the other way, and I had blood coming out of my mouth. So that was my first introduction to Larry Bird. Well, it was a close game. They beat us. Well, ended up being my last college game. Indiana State was playing at Butler. You know, it was a big game, and that was, you know, we didn't draw huge crowds. It wasn't anything like what Butler is now. And he came in there, and we held him, I think, to 47 points. And that was before the three-point line. He was a man among boys.
Yeah.
I look back at all the really good athletes I played against. He by far was the best.
So what was your major in college?
Well, that's an interesting story, too. I went, and like most kids at that time, you kind of did something similar to what your parents did or your family did. So I went to be a business major. I think it was early in my sophomore year. I got in an accounting class that was prerequisite, and it just kicked it was really hard.
Yeah.
And I was a decent student. I remember this. I was thinking, I can't do this. And we were coming home from a football game. I'm on the bus. I think I'm even pulled a book out, like I was studying coming home from a football game. And, you know, you hear all the guys in the back of the bus, you know, yucking it up and having fun.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, what am I doing? And when we got back home, there was a guy that was 2 years older than me, a senior, Ott Hurley. Ott was a good friend, but, you know, he was a couple years older than me at that time and ended up being great friends. And he's still the head football coach at Cecina High School. But anyway, I said, I'm studying this business stuff, and it's kicking my butt. And I said, what are you going to do? And I remember he said, no, I don't want to work. I'm going to teach and coach. I kind of looked at him, what are you talking about? He goes, you go get an education, and then you can get on track and be a teacher and a coach. And that was on a Saturday coming home from a game, and by Monday I was in registrar's office, and I want to change my major. So I ended up being in education. This is kind of interesting, too. I did the whole thing, did my student teaching. In fact, I did my student teaching at Cecina High School, where Odd Hurley was teaching and coaching because he had graduated. I did all that, and then I was deciding where I was going to go teach and coach. I had a chance to go there. I had a chance to go to Ben Davis High School. It wasn't as big a school as it is now. But both places, I would have been an assistant football coach, maybe a freshman basketball coach. And we had gotten married in the 1st of June, and I still didn't have a job. Linda was working, the nurse.
Yeah.
And I hadn't taken a job yet. Bill Sylvester, who I mentioned was my football coach and athletic director, he had an assistant coach that left in the summertime to go out to California. So there was an assistant football coach position open. Bill Sylvester offered me a job, and it was paid $8,000 to be an assistant football coach. And I said, I'll take it. I coached really in college the rest of my career, except for one short year in some pro ball.
So going back to college for a little bit, so you were in a fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
What made you join a fraternity?
Butler at the time was a little bit of a commuter school. You know, you got a lot of Indianapolis kids who went, and if you lived on campus, though, you most were in fraternity. So anyway, it was one of those deals where, again, my senior year, and coming to Butler, and there wasn't a, what do you call it, recruitment type deal or rush or anything like that. It was every man for himself, and you know, there was football players calling me and saying, hey, come join our fraternity. I made a real strategic decision. Lambda Chi House was the closest one to Hinkle Field House, where I felt like I was going to spend all my time until my priorities were. So I became a Lambda Chi. Ended up being great experience, friends to this day, don't regret it at all. And really, because I went 5 years, because I missed a year playing because I had hurt a knee, and in those days you could work on your master's as an undergraduate. So I was in a fraternity house for 4.5 years, so that was enough, but it was a good experience, and again, a lot of good friends from those days.
Can you think of any funny stories from
fraternity house?
Yeah.
None that I want to talk about on this podcast.
Tell me about when you snuck into the National Convention, the Republican National Convention, you said?
So let's go back. It was the summer of 1976, and I was going a fifth year. Most of my buddies had graduated in May. I was going to go another year. And a good friend named David Oliver, who was attorney brother, wide receiver on the football team, good friend, he had graduated, and he was interested in politics. And obviously, back then, you didn't have the coverage that you see now.
No.
Cable television, there wasn't the onslaught of politics that you get now. But you're young and you're in college and you follow what's going on. And he wanted to go to the Republican National Convention. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, would you go with me? I said, well, where are we going to stay? What are we going to do? Well, there was a guy named Tom Keating. Oh, he was a human interest story writer for the Indianapolis Star. He was very, very popular. And we knew the family. Tom also was the sports information director at Butler. I mean, it was like a part-time thing. So we had gotten known. Well, Dave, I didn't know this, had gone to Tom and said, Bill Lynch and I want to go to the convention, and he knew he was going to be there covering it. He said, what do we do? And he said, I'll tell you what, if you guys get out there, you can stay in my room with me. So, okay, now we got a place to stay. So we get in the car and we drive to Kansas. It was in Kansas City. And Gerald Ford was the president because he took over for Richard Nixon. And I don't know if the Democratic convention had already been held, but Jimmy Carter was going to be who he was going to run against. Well, anyway, we get out there. I'll never forget this. We have no idea we're going to go. And we get to this hotel to go check in. You're polite and you hold a door for somebody. I hold the door, and I'll be darned if the guy doesn't walk through with a group of people was Ronald Reagan. Now, Ronald Reagan was the governor of the state of California at the time, but growing in Republican politics.
Yeah.
But clearly, he was running against Ford, but he wasn't quite ready. He ended up 4 years later.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, I'm holding the door. I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, that's Ronald Reagan. So all of a sudden, you realize, hey, we're kind of mixing with the big guys here, you know.
Uh-huh.
So the first couple nights at the convention are a lot of speaking, nothing all that important. But we went, and then one night, Keating got us tickets to the Kansas City Royals baseball game, and it was a brand new stadium in Kansas City, so we thought we went. One of the first times I got a chance to go to something like that in Kansas City. Anyway, so now we're coming to the night where they're going to pick the candidate. Well, Keating had two tickets. He had to go because he was working. And so the other ticket, it was either going to be myself or Dave Oliver. So we flipped the coin. I lost. So Oliver gets the ticket. What are you going to do, Bill? I said, I'll get there. You're 21 years old, 22 years old. You know, you got...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, I went. I got, you know, got dressed up, had a coat and tie on. And I get to the building. And even back then, there was fencing all the way. It was, you know, around the place. And you had to get inside the fencing to walk 40 yards to the arena to get in. Well, some way, I kind of bluffed my way through the first fence. Got in, I'm walking. I go around the back of this arena. I mean, it's like going to any other kind of basketball arena where they held a convention at that time. And I got back in the back, and I got cornered where all the different TV...
Yeah, media.
Yeah, but I'm talking about where they brought in the trailers and...
Like unloading.
Exactly.
Like the
so I'm back there.
Way.
So I get up near the door, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I don't have a credentials, 22 years old.
Yeah.
I might get arrested.
Uh-huh.
So I'm almost panicking. Well, all of a sudden, the door opens, and the TV cameras come out. And there was a senator coming up with his family, and he was in the, you know, whatever. Now remember, this is just a couple years after Watergate, which, you know, obviously a big thing in history. So anyway, he walks in, and his family comes, and all of a sudden I jump in with his family, and he's introducing his sons, and all of a sudden he points at me, and I took off running.
Yeah.
And I jumped, you know, like a turnstile. I jumped over the turnstile and started running down the hall. And as I'm thinking, I'm going to get shot, I'm going to get arrested, I went about halfway around, and I jumped in and went upstairs to, like, go sit down, and I went all the way to the top of the arena, and I just sat down, kind of buried my hands, and my heart's pounding, I'm thinking, I'm going to get arrested. Well, about 10 minutes later, I look up, there's nobody coming after. So, I snuck in. I wasn't all that interested, to tell you the truth, but I was there. So now I got 30 minutes under my belt, so now I'm going to go down and walk around the arena and see what's going on. Well, I run into Tom Keating, and I tell him the story. He dies laughing.
Yeah.
I mean, he just thinks this is great. He says, you want to do one more thing that's crazy? And I said, yeah. And he said, you know the name William Ruckelshaus? I said, sure, he's from Indianapolis. And I'm thinking to myself, I know my Linda had babysat for a Ruckelshaus in Indianapolis. Had to be related.
Yeah.
Might have been him. I don't know. But anyway, I said, sure, I know about him in Indianapolis and all that stuff. He says, well, the media are so gullible about finding a story. He says, I'll set you up. So the next thing I know, he brings this media around me, and we're in the concourse, and I start talking about William Ruckelshaus from Indianapolis. Da, da, da. And then I look, and now TV cameras are on me, and there's media about 4D. Now I'm about ready to panic again. No further comment. And I slip out, and I go, and Tom Keating, who set the whole thing up, he's leaning against the wall, dying laughing. I mean, it was... So anyway, the evening ends. I go back. We get up, 6 o'clock in the morning, drive back to Indianapolis. And I remember, it's 8 o'clock that night, and I was tired. I wasn't going out. And my dad's sitting in the room watching the Republican National Convention on television. I go in and sit down next to him, and he knew I went, but he really didn't ask me too many questions or what happened. And he said, anything interesting happened? I remember saying, no. No, not really. And I'm sitting there watching this time thinking, I could have got arrested last night.
Yeah.
And now I'm sitting back home acting like nothing happened. But anyway, it was something you might do at that age, but I really wouldn't recommend it to anybody else.
And there was some story, was it a Vikings game?
Oh, yeah, that was a different thing. We played basketball in a holiday tournament in Minneapolis. You know, there were four teams, and so you played one night. Then you had an off night, and then you played, you know, the next game. And it was really, really cold, and the radio voice of the Minnesota Vikings at the time was a guy from Indianapolis, and he knew Butler basketball was there. He got us tickets to go to the football game if we wanted to go. And the other thing I remember in the hotel we were staying in was the CBS TV crew, and it was Phyllis George. I don't know if that name means anything. I saw where she recently passed away, but she was the first female sportscaster.
Oh, really?
Who, you know, was, that was 1975 or 1976. It was a big deal. She was probably 25, 26 years old. But also in the hotel, the other two was one, Johnny Unitas, who at the time had just retired from playing, and he was, you know, I mean, he was the quarterback for 20 years. And then Brett Musburger was a young, new TV guy. And I remember they were going to the game. We were talking to him in the hallway and all that. So we went to the game, and all the players went. So they were like, "Damn, well, as cold as can be." And nobody, you know, took the clothing. Nobody expected to be sitting out in an outdoor pro football game. Well, anyway, everybody left. About halftime, they all said, "I'm not staying." I'm sitting there saying, "I'm not leaving."
Yeah.
So I sitting there freezing my... But anyway, I stayed to the end, and it was a famous, famous finish of a Roger Staubach Hail Mary pass, and it might have been when the Hail Mary pass came into play.
Yeah.
And a wide receiver for the Cowboys caught it in the corner of the end zone, and the Cowboys upset the Vikings on that cold day. And, I mean, it's one of those that's still replayed. And the other thing that happened, some drunk up in the stands was mad at the official for calling a touchdown, threw a bottle, hit the official, almost killed the official.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was kind of a historic, eventful game, and I about froze, but I wasn't going
to
leave.
Yeah, you stayed to the end.
So I stayed to the end, and it didn't hurt my shooting the next night because I couldn't shoot very well anyway. So
yeah.
Anyway, yeah, that was an interesting day.
So I know you just told the story of how you got into coaching,
uh-huh.
But you did do like a little tryout for the NFL, correct? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was, you know, I wasn't good enough to play. But, you know, you think, and if you can get a chance. And Hank Stram was the head coach of the New Orleans Saints at the time. But he had been the famous head coach of the Kansas City Chiefs that won a Super Bowl upset. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you ever see the old thing. He was the coach that said, "We're going to matriculate the ball down the field." I mean, he was kind of a colorful character. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he had coached at Purdue at one time. And again, this was kind of a friend of my uncle's, who the guy was his high school football coach, whatever. But they kind of stayed close. And he followed me from afar. And he heard Stram was, you know, going to come. And he was representing Gatorade at the Indianapolis 500. And he said, "How about, you got time while you're in town, how about go working this kid out? You know, he's worth looking at." And I really didn't know what was happening. All of a sudden, I get a phone call, and Hank Stram on the phone. I'm thinking, "Oh my God, Hank Stram." And he says, "Hey, kid," he goes, "I've heard about you." And he goes, "I'm going to be in Indianapolis for the 500. He said, "Can you come pick me up, and I'll go work you out after the race?" And I, "Absolutely, I'll do that." So it was probably one of the few times in the last 50 years I haven't gone to the Indianapolis 500, but I didn't think it was a good idea to go to the 500 with my buddies and then go work out for an NFL coach. So anyway, I stayed home, waited for his call, went downtown, picked him up, took him back out to Butler. And he said, "Let's just go work out at Butler." He goes, "I remember playing a baseball game at Butler when I was a young college kid." So anyway, so I went, and I got my buddy Dave Oliver, who went to the Republican National Convention with me. He was a receiver, somebody to throw to and all that. I do it. We get done. We get in the car. I'm driving it back downtown, and it's dead silent. And he's not saying anything. He's just looking out the window. And I'm kind of like, "Tell me something." And finally I said, "Well, coach, what'd you think?" He says, "Well, kids, you got anything else going?" You know, I knew right away what that meant.
Yeah.
So anyway, I said, "Yeah, I think I got a chance to be a high school coach, or... at that time I didn't know I was going to end up at Butler, but I probably could get a GA position in college."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I remember he called me kid. He said, "Well, kid, I think that'd be a great idea." He said, "Let me tell you what." And he said, "You'd be a good guy to come in and throw balls to the running backs or something like that." He says, "But you're not big enough or strong enough to be an NFL quarterback. So if you got a chance, you know, to get into coaching now," he says, "I'd do it."
Yeah.
He said, "Rather than wasting time, you know,
trying it.
And so, as you look back at it, you're disappointed, but you realize it was the best advice you could ever get. And I appreciated his honesty. You know, he could say, "Well, maybe if this, you know, you just, you know, go get a coaching job and get in that." So I knew that's what I wanted to do, but he probably convinced me I better do it sooner rather than later.
Yeah. So obviously you started off at Butler.
Uh-huh.
But could you explain the order of then where you went from Butler to coach?
Yeah. It's interesting. All these places I'm talking about, I've been an assistant coach at four places and head coach at the same four places.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. I was at Butler, assistant coach, for 7 years, I think. We had some success, and we had some good teams. But it's ready to try something else and financially try to move up a little bit.
Yeah.
And so Lee Corso, who had been the head coach at Indiana, he just became the head football coach at Northern Illinois. And somebody had recommended me to Lee Corso, and he called me and said, I want to meet you and I want to talk. So he offered me the offensive coordinator's position at Northern Illinois. So I went with him. Northern didn't know, but we were playing 11-game schedules, and after the ninth game, he left. We were in DeKalb, Illinois, but he had a chance to go coach in the USFL, which was the United States Football League that was competing against the NFL at the time and playing a spring league.
Yeah.
So he went, and a good friend, Ted Huber, became the acting head coach for the last two games there. Season's over. They brought in a new coach who was a wishbone offensive coach, and I was a pro-style offensive coach, so I was the first guy to lose my job because I didn't fit what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
But Coach Corso took care of me, and he knew we had three, young children at the time. So he brought me down to Orlando when I was the quarterback coach with the Orlando Renegades. Well, what happened is the USFL trying to get into the NFL. In fact, we were playing a spring league, and so they went to court or whatever to try to go in the fall.
Yeah.
So they decided to disband the USFL. So now we had moved from Indianapolis, where we both grew up, had three kids. We went to DeKalb, Illinois, and lost our job before the season was over. Moved to Florida, coaching the USFL, lost our job before the season was over. So now we didn't know what we were going to do. And you got to be lucky. But Bill Sylvester, who was my college coach,
yeah,
Ed Butler, and the athletic director, he called me and asked me what I was doing. I said, I need a job. He said, why don't you come back and be the head coach, and I'll just be the AD. I mean, I was 30 years old, and
yeah.
I thought, I couldn't get back to Indianapolis quick enough.
Uh-huh.
Came back to Indy, and then I was the head coach there for 5 years. Then they were making some changes at Butler in terms of what level of football they wanted to play in relation to, they needed to build a basketball program, and they did. They made the right decision, but it was tough for me. I was 35, and time to move on.
Yeah.
And so I had a chance to go to Ball State as an assistant coach for Paul Shudell. Did that for 3 years, and then got a chance to go down and be an assistant at IU for Bill Mallory. Those are two really well-respected guys in the profession. I was really lucky. I went from Lee Corso to Paul Shudell to Bill Mallory. And was there 2 years, and then the Ball State job opened up. Paul decided to move on, and so I ended up getting the head job at Ball State, and I was there 8 years, and then got let go, and then trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and I ended up taking the DePaul job. Their coaching position opened up, and fortunate enough to be the head coach, had some success, and then my good friend Terry Heppner got the head job at Indiana, and not only he being a good friend, but my son Billy was on his staff at Miami, Ohio, and he was going too. So anyway, it was a chance to coach with Terry, it was a chance to coach with Billy, so I decided to leave DePaul, and I went back down to Bloomington. So at this point, I had coached at Butler twice, once as assistant, once as head coach. Ball State twice, once as assistant, once as a head coach. I'd been in Indiana, and then at the end of really the second year, Terry had gotten really sick and unfortunately passed away. So then I was elevated to the head coach. So did 4 years of that. So again, so there's another school that I've been assistant, then the head coach. And then got let go after the 2010 season. And really, that time kind of thought I was going to get out of coaching. And Barry Collier, my good friend, going back to being a fraternity brother and basketball teammate, hired me to come to Butler, and they had a big project going, particularly with athletic Hinkle Field House. And so Linda and I decided, we can move back to Indianapolis and give that a whirl. And I really enjoyed it, but then the DePaul job opened again.
And you missed coaching?
I missed coaching. I really did. That was hard to tell Barry that I was going, but he was great about it. So anyway, had a chance to come back to DePaul, and 7 years later finished. So I coached at Butler twice, IU twice, Ball State twice, DePaul twice.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Never had to move too far other than the 1 6 months we were down in Orlando. So we're fortunate to be able to stay around family through all that time.
Where was your favorite place to coach?
I liked them all. Good, I had good, great staff. obviously you like the places where you have a chance to have success, and
yeah,
and Butler, my school, so that was always special. Mm-hmm. I really, really enjoyed DePaul. I was only there a year and left, and when I had that job at Butler and told my buddies I was going back to DePaul, they thought, why are you doing that? I said, you don't understand, it's a great place. I stayed in touch with the DePaul people because they could have been upset with me because I was only there a year and left, but for me it was an easy decision, and looking back, really glad I did it.
Mm-hmm. When did you get the box of gum?
That's been a pain in the neck. You think about it, a lot of people, they remember that much more than any game I coached or anything I did, with throwing gum up in the stands. It's like, gosh.
Yeah. So obviously you've coached IU and then DePaul, a tiny school.
Right.
What would you say is like the best thing about coaching at a big school and the worst thing, and then vice versa for a small school?
Oh, at the big school, you have all the, let's say, toys around you to help you be successful. Because you got a big budget, and you can buy all the practice gear and all this and all that, and recruiting services, and you can jump on a plane and fly to recruit a kid. And
yeah.
I mean, you just have all those things at that level. So that's kind of fun. You have all that at your disposal. You don't have to do the laundry.
Yeah.
You don't have to line the field. You don't have to, do the things that at a smaller school you've got to do, because there's not enough personnel to do it. And there's a challenge to competing against the very best.
Mm-hmm.
That's invigorating, and that's keeps you awake at night, but it also motivates you when you get up in the morning. I got to go to work now because we're playing Michigan this week, or we're playing Ohio State, or those kind of things. So I'm glad I got a chance to do it.
Yeah.
The thing I really enjoyed about coaching at Butler and DePaul was it was the experience I had as a player. And I know how much fun I had at Butler as a student athlete, but as a student and an attorney guy, just had a ball. I mean, I did it for 5 years because I had that much fun. And so coaching guys at those two schools, I knew how much fun they had going to school, and that football was not going to be their life. But when they came to practice, they came to play. And on Saturdays, it meant just as much to them as it did the guys playing at Michigan or Michigan State. Mm-hmm. I firmly believe that. A win's a win, a loss is a loss. I don't care what level you're at. The guys I coached at Butler and the guys I coached at DePaul, they could do all three. They could get a great education. They could compete like crazy in football. But they still had time to have fun.
Back to what you said at IU or at the bigger schools, you didn't have to do all this stuff. Didn't you 2 years ago at the Paul Wabash game, you cleaned up the locker room? Can you tell that story?
Oh, yeah. That's something funny. I did that at IU and Ball State, too. It was back to Bill Sylvester, who was my coach. He always told us that. Leave it better than when you got here. So when you go in the locker room, it's clean. Make it even cleaner than when you got here. So that always resonated with me.
What's your favorite memory from
coach? Oh, God. Winning games. Because that helps you stay in your job.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's the whole thing. It's the coaches you work with, so close to them, the players you work with, the older you get, catching up with former players and what they're doing and where they're at. And, the older you get, the more you appreciate all those things. When you're young, it's all about X's and O's. It's about how are we going to get this first down, this fancy offense, and this and that. But the older you go, it's more about the relationships and the people you're with. And if you can be with a group of really good people that you like, because you spend a lot of time together, and there's a lot of hours involved, and you're with a group of people you don't like or don't enjoy or don't trust, can make life miserable. But I'm really fortunate to be around good, loyal people, through the different stops.
What did coaching teach you?
I think it's like any profession. You learn from the people you're around, the people you meet. It's generally about the people, more so than anything else. Football, it's hard for me to talk about the business world or the corporate world or any of those things because I never experienced that. But the one thing I always thought about coaching that was so important and really fortunate through the years is you need a group that are going to work hard and going to be loyal to one another. Because I think loyalty is something that's so important, because you can get in a situation, whether it's coaching or anything professionally, where if you got people that are looking out for themselves rather than looking out for the group and being, loyal to the, whether it's the leader or the philosophy of the place, things go downhill in a hurry. And that part of it was really fortunate that was around really good, hard-working, loyal people that made the job fun.
Who did he look up to the most as a coach?
Oh, I would say Bill Sylvester, who was my coach. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've had a lot of success. The way he treated people, he was really an honest, loyal, hard-working guy. I mean, but, you know, through the stops, Lee Corso was a tremendous guy to work for. Bill Mallory was good as they come, and he coached a lot of places and had a lot of success. His sons all became coaches. There's a lot of, obviously, Terry Hepner was a great friend, and in the short time I got to coach with him, I really enjoyed that. So, really lucky, really haven't been around bad people.
No.
You know, that's, as much as I moved, I was fortunate. Same thing with athletic directors. I really got to work for some really, really good athletic directors and people I enjoyed, people that were honest and people you could trust. And, you know, that makes the job better, too.
Yeah. What made you finally decide to retire?
You know, what's interesting, I just knew. I heard older guys tell me that. You know, when do you know? And it was last summer. Mm-hmm. That I just knew this was going to be my last year. I don't know. It can be a lot of different things. My health probably wasn't great. That might have had something to do with my energy level. But it was just, I just knew the time was going to be right. And didn't say anything to anybody. I said something to Linda, but I really didn't. Because I never wanted to be that coach that lost his energy, who didn't have the same passion for it every day, you know, mm-hmm. when you go into work.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I just, you know, we're sitting here, what should be preseason football camp, if not for the pandemic, and I wouldn't have been ready to go back to being a football coach, so I feel good about when I decided to get out. Mm-hmm.
And you ended on a good note.
Oh, yeah. Anytime to Paul B. Twalbash, that's a good note.
Uh-huh. All right, so transitioning away from coaching, how did you meet Mimi, Linda?
I remember it. It was, golly, her family moved to the Broadupple area when she was about 6th or 7th grade. And I was a year behind her, but she had a brother that was in my class. But when I really first met her, this would be 1964, 1965, 66. I don't know what it would have been. But anyway, I grew up. Broadupple Park was right across the street. And the movie Sandlot.
Yeah.
That was us. I mean, we had a group, and we went down to the park, and we played baseball. And there was nothing going to stop the baseball game. Well, one of the guys that was part of it, who was a year older than me, he said, "We're not going to play this afternoon." "What do you mean we're not going to play?" I was Squints. That's who I was. And I said, "What are you talking about?" "No, nah, come on, why don't you come with me? We're getting my bike there. There's this new girl. You know, I want to go visit this new girl. Why don't you ride with me?" Oh, man. I was like I say, Squints. What are we doing? We're not playing baseball. We're going to talk to a girl?
Yeah.
So we get in the, it was probably a 6-block ride on the bike, but to me it was like going to the other side of the earth.
Uh-huh.
And we go down there, and there's this girl, and I think her little sister. So I think it was Luann with her. They were standing out, and she was, you know, Linda being Linda, this boy.
Uh-huh.
And talking and all that stuff. And I remember just sitting there on my bike or standing.
She just wanted to go play.
Oh, so furious. And I was even more furious. So why did he talk me into going down there? He probably because he knew he could grab me and say, "You're going with me." That's the first time I met her. So I didn't go all that well. But she wasn't any interested in me either. So it's not like she wanted the other guy. So then we'd go to school.
Uh-huh.
And her brother Rick's in my class. And, you know, I mean, it all lined up. So, you know, we did a lot of things together. I mean, not Rick, or I did, you know, it really wasn't, you know, we never dated until we got in high school. No, that's when I first met her.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a great meeting for me, and she probably doesn't even remember it. So, I mean, that's more, she was interested in that other guy.
How did you finally start dating?
Oh, I don't know. While we were in high school, she was a class ahead of me. Got closer and closer and decided to start dating a little bit. But we started dating. I didn't have a driver's license.
Really?
No. I wasn't 16 years old yet. But she didn't have a driver's license either. She wasn't ready to get one, I guess.
Didn't she fail her test a few times?
Couldn't parallel park. Well, anyway.
To this day.
I remember her mother a couple times. I'd get over to their house and hang out. She'd drive me home.
Yeah.
It wasn't that far, but that was very nice for Aggie to do that because she had 8 kids to take care of, and her dad was, you know, generally working nights. as a policeman. So that's kind of where it started. And then, you know, we went through the rest of high school and then going to Butler. There was probably a little bit of that too, because she was in town. She was going to go to a nursing school in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we dated all the way through college.
What did you think of the Lexes?
You know, in those days, there were a lot of Catholic big families.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they weren't the only ones that we went to school with. And we all got along well. Like I said, Rick being in my class, you know, we played basketball together and football together and all those kind of things. But, you know, the more I was around him, the more I got to know everybody. It goes all the way to, here's how things have changed. I was playing college basketball at Butler. And my senior year, when you think, you know, you got walkthroughs or meetings the day of the game. We always played on at night back then, not in the afternoon. I coached her youngest brother, Matt's CYO basketball team in the winter.
Really?
Coached her team, got done. I went to Butler and played a basketball game at night. You know, really got pretty close with the family.
Obviously, you and Mimi dated for a really long time before you actually got married.
Mm-hmm.
What made you fall in love with her?
Oh, you know her well. She's the same today as she was back then. She's fun to be around. But I don't know when, you know, you finally make a decision. But I think she was all about family. Family was important to me. Saw how she treated her brothers and sisters. I saw her babysit, go and, you know, that was a date sometime, babysit, how she treated kids. You know, I mean, it just, I don't know what hits you, but you realize
yeah.
those are qualities you really like.
Yeah.
I think we both had the same values from faith and our, kind of how we grew up. She's easy to like. You know, people that get to know her know she's fun and got a good sense of humor and likes to have fun. And whether it's with adults or certainly she does with the grandkids and little kids as well.
When did you get married?
We got married June 4th, 1977.
Was it a big wedding?
Yeah, both had a lot of friends and we shared so much because, you know, we grew up in the same neighborhood, we went to the same high school, and then essentially we went to the same college, you know, so
yeah.
all those friends were, but it wasn't like, well, they're friends on this side of the family, they're like, friends on that.
I think it was Billy or Kevin, one of the two, wanted me to ask you this. What do you think about the happy wife, happy life philosophy, and how has that affected your finances over the years?
I can answer that in one word, QVC. She is all American QVC. She is first team all American QVC.
And then also Kevin wanted to know how much money you think that you've spent or how much time you spent going to get fountain pops from you.
Oh my God. She's got an addictive personality. And it's
yeah.
good things it never was drugs.
Yeah.
But it is with her pop.
Uh-huh.
And oh my gosh. She's got dear friends in Indianapolis, Bloomington, Greencastle, Muncie, all at the whatever fountain pop place was through the years. On a first name basis. What she's got now, she doesn't even have to pay full price. Throws a dollar down and they say, nice see ya. She's got that working pretty good.
Yeah, but in all seriousness, what do you think is the key to a successful marriage? You've obviously been married for
yeah.
a long time.
Well, trust and respect, and you gotta really enjoy the person, being around the person. You know, I mean, it's not, you're gonna be together a lot, and that's, you want to be with somebody you really enjoy being with, and also share the same values, you know, because you raise a family, things are going to come up with your kids or with your life, and if you share the same values, and some of that goes back to sharing the same faith, it gets you through the tough times, and we've been very fortunate that way.
So, what would the Bill of today tell himself as a young husband and parent?
You know what, I don't look back and regret too much. I think like anything else in life, you learn as you go, but I don't think, I wish I would have done this or I wish I would have done that. We've been pretty blessed, you know, with the four kids and good health and all of them adjusted well to when we made the different moves, which you never know exactly how that's going to work. But we're fortunate there. Each move, they adapted, met new friends, you know, didn't really overly affect their life, I don't think.
How would you break the news to your kids whenever it was time to move?
I don't think any of them happened overnight. The first move when we left Butler, financially, we needed to make more money. We had three kids and knew we wanted to have more. We weren't making enough money to do what we needed to do. So when the opportunity came, that was more financial. Then after that, we moved to Florida, was out of necessity. We didn't have a job. And then moved back to Indianapolis at Butler. Kind of a passion for mine going back home. But it was a necessity. We didn't have a job in Florida.
Yeah.
And then after that, some of the moves were, because we we thought it would be, you know, be better professionally, be better financially. Mm-hmm. And then a couple times, you know, when you get fired, you got to make some decisions, you know, what the next step is too. So we've made a lot of moves. Each one of them had a little different motivation. I don't think any of them we argued about. I mean, I don't think it was like, I got to talk her into this one. I think for the most part, and fortunately, other than the Florida one, I guess Northern Illinois was a little bit that way. None of them were that far away from home. You know, I mean, family is so important to your grandmother, but it was never like this. We can't do that. I mean, Florida obviously would have been tough, but it only lasted 6 months, and she got about 50 trips to Disney World in that time, because you never know how many friends you have until you live in Orlando, and Disney World was only about 4 years old at the time, so everybody wanted to come down and visit the Lynch's because it was champ to go to Disney World.
What have you learned from moving around and living in different communities?
I think the first thing is there's good people everywhere. You know, Linda and I, we grew up you grew up in Muncie, Indiana?
Yeah.
I think that's small. Well, you grew up in Indianapolis. You don't live in Indiana. You live in your neighborhood and your school and your church. That's who you know. And every place is pretty similar that way. You find your niche and you find your groove. Kids help you meet other adults. Now, when you're coaching, you know, you've got a fill-in group that you're pretty close with anyway, and your families end up being pretty close because the time demands are similar for each family, and so they have to rely on each other a little bit that way.
Where was the favorite place that you lived?
Shoot, I enjoyed them all. Obviously Indianapolis, but even time that we went back to Butler, we moved in Fishers, and Fishers at that time was like a different city. It's different. You know, in 1985, when we moved up there, in fact, the people at Butler thought, you know, what are you living all the way out there for? I mean, that was kind of unheard of. But it ended up, you know, we loved that. We met great friends in Muncie both times we went. Different set of friends, although the kids elementary school the first time, and the second time they were more in high school. So for the most part, they all worked out.
How old were you when you had Billy?
Well, it was 1978, so I was 24.
Would you say that you always wanted to have four kids?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there were four in our family, and of course, there were eight in hers, but I think we knew we were going to have at least four kids. I mean, I don't think that was ever a discussion about, no, that's enough. It was all worked out.
Yeah. As a parent, what lesson did you stress the most, would you say, to your kids?
I think being honest. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, if there was one thing that ever really, really, you know, would get you upset is if you knew one of your kids was lying to you. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that stands out to me a little bit. About like loyalty does in coaching.
Yeah.
Honesty, I think, does in family. I think faith comes in there at some point, that you hope your kids continue their faith as they grow, get older, life changes, and we've been very fortunate that way, I think, that all four have been and raised their families in faith. That was, I'd say, important to Linda and I. Seeing the youngest, I don't know if it's in everything, but certainly with Kevin, he took it all in. I mean, he watched his older siblings, and, you know, that's part of why he's such a, I don't know if it's comical.
Funny guy.
I guess really one thing, he's got a great memory of things, because he took it all in as a young kid and watched it. And he can even tell you episodes where I probably lost my temper at one of the older kids. He could mimic me and, you know, exactly what happened. He was a little kid hiding down the stairs watching it or whatever, you know.
It is pretty amazing that all of your kids did end up graduating from Delta.
It's amazing. It really is.
Unheard of.
Totally unheard of, particularly for somebody who didn't stay there the entire time.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's amazing is all four of them married Muncie kids. In this day and age, that's incredible. But it's also made it really fun because Muncie's home to everybody.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's a lot of coach kids that home is different to different kids.
Uh-huh.
You know, based on where they lived and their friends and all that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, who they marry and where, you know, all those kind of things work. Ours is all in one place.
Yeah. Would you say that's why the Timothy Way house is so special? I feel like all of the kids always talk about that house. At least Kevin does.
And
Joey.
Because that's where they really, they all grew up there, but.
We lived there the longest.
Yeah.
That's why.
We were there 8 years.
So we talked about, or you said that one of the things that you're most fortunate about is that all of your kids wanted to have big families or have been able to have bigger families.
Uh-huh.
So obviously you're a grandpa out of 17.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say is your favorite part about being a grandpa?
Oh, I you know, it's the age-old thing that you can have fun with them and do whatever you want, but you're not responsible for, you know, the hard talks or the being home on time or who you're going out with or all those kind of things that as a parent you got to do. As a grandparent, you can love them up and have fun with them and make sure mom and dad take care of them.
That's
a big difference.
What would you say is the best part about watching your kids as parents?
Oh, I think that's phenomenal. Linda and I have talked about that a lot. And again, I feel very fortunate. Very fortunate for, not surprised that our kids are good parents, but fortunate that they married, their spouses are good parents. You know, there seems like everybody's within their families on the same page. That doesn't always happen. That's something we're very fortunate.
What parenting advice do you have?
I couldn't write a book on it. Like one of those things where I can, when I see it, I say, that's good parenting. You know what I mean? You got to kind of have a feel. But I think it's the same thing as I said, what do you expect of your kids? You want your kids to be honest with you. I think you got to be honest with your kids.
Yeah.
And they got to be able to trust you. They can be mad at you, but they got to know you love them and that you have their best interests in heart, and your experience tells you this is not a good thing to do or this is a good, you know, that kind of thing.
As you look back on your life, who are the people who have the greatest impact on you or influenced you the most?
Parents, first and foremost. And I wouldn't pick one over the other. Other than my dad, you know, being a male, and I think he was a good male role model, a good husband role model, good dad role model. That would be clearly, obviously, Linda, you know, good role model. I think she's a great mother, great grandmother. Coaches, I think when you're really young, they have an influence. Dick Dullahan, my high school football coach, he had a big influence almost to this day because I've kind of been in business with him too. Bill Sylvester, interesting guy in that he recruited me to Butler. He gave me my first job at Butler, and he gave me my first head coaching job. They were all at Butler. That's pretty special.
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't happen. So he obviously had a big influence. You know what, though? Haven't talked about him. I had an uncle, Bill Connor, who was an interesting guy. He never married. He was a lifelong bachelor. Mm-hmm. And he was identical. He was my dad's age, so obviously had a lot in common. He was a guy that had an influence growing up because they lived right down the street from him for a long time. I mean, for a while. But he lived with his mother, which was my grandmother. So that was kind of fun as a kid. It was like four doors down. I'd go down and see my grandma, and she'd spoil me. And and see an uncle who, he had a real influence on me. He was a real sports guy. Kind of forgot him, but he, especially at a young age, and Linda would know that too.
What advice would you give to a 20-year-old?
Do exactly what you're doing, and that is try it all. You know, I mean in a positive way. Don't be afraid to do all the things that you get a chance to do at your age. Don't get too pigeonholed into one thing, and this is what I am, and everything else be damned. I'm focused on this because I think you miss out on a lot, and you learn from every experience, whether it's a positive experience or not. Quite honestly, doing a little advertisement here, and that's why I think DePaul's a tremendous place, because DePaul sells that and creates opportunities, and I think that's really important for a young person is get involved, find, because you're going to learn with each thing until you finally, the big picture open up, this is what you want to do.
Do you regret anything from your life?
Yeah, it was 1985, and we were at Wittenberg, and I ran the ISO one time and got stuffed, and we lost the game. No. In coaching, you regret a lot of things after a loss, and it takes you a few days to get over that. Other than that, no.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't second guess. The one thing that I'm glad I didn't get caught up in, and Linda had probably some influence here, there were different times when I had to change jobs or something happened. You know, you can chase something far away, and, you know, we were fortunate that opportunities came where we could stay pretty close. You know, like I said, the experience in Orlando was good. The experience, you know, but the Cal wasn't that far. But for the most part, we were fortunate enough that we were able to stay pretty close to family and still get a chance to raise a family and be able to do the things we wanted to do.
Yeah. So far, like, what has been your favorite memory?
Better say my wedding day, right? since she should have got here? Huh?
No, I, you know, obviously that's big a day as you're going to have in life.
But, you know, I'm not coaching. I've never been, this win was bigger than that win. Or, you know, that was so exciting. But yeah, exactly. And a loss is a loss. I mean, you know what's interesting though?
Your family and your kids become so important to you
that you were there last game I coached. We beat Wabash in an exciting game. And that's, you know, if you're going to coach at Wabash or DePaul, you know, that's the game you want to win.
But I remember we won and we came right home because Ball State was playing. And they were at that point where they were getting pretty good. They needed to win. And they lost a really tough, close game. And I remember sitting upstairs just devastated when they got beat at the end. And it was like, I forgot all about the Bell game because your kids.
You're more concerned with this.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when, you know, I've been around enough that I've had some big wins in my life. You know, it wasn't like, you know, the world was going to end one way or the other. But I've also been fired. In some of those games, you watch your kids coaching in, that this may make the difference whether you have a job or not.
Yeah.
And then you know that it not only affects them, but it affects their families. So I that stood out to me. I thought about that later that night. I was sick about they lost a tight game at the end, forgot all about, you know, the Bell game. I think that shows, you know, what family does, that it just overrides anything else.
Mm-hmm. So that would maybe go into my next question then. What do you believe is the most important thing in life?
Family. And family and faith. I mean, I think hopefully it's
hand in hand.
Yeah, I really do. But and again, I feel proud of our family, that I do think there's care about one another, but certainly have kept their faith and have grown in faith, I think. But that's the most important thing.
What's the best advice you've ever been given?
It was probably someone telling you, don't let her get away.
You know, I really think it was my dad, and his was, make sure you find a career that you really enjoy going to work, that you really, really enjoy it. Because in all honesty, I'm not sure his was that way. He made a good living. He was really good at what he did. I mean, his name's on all kinds of buildings around Indianapolis as a structural engineer. But I think he got forced into it because he was a depression kid. Dad died when he was in high school. Had to go to Purdue because that's where his brothers were. At that time, I think if you went to Purdue, you're probably going to be an engineer. Then he had to go to World War II, and then he came home, and he had to, so he was an engineer. And again, I think he did well, obviously, but I'm not sure he ever loved it. I think it was a job. Different times he would tell me that, make sure you do something that you really love. And that's why when I got in coaching, he was really supportive.
There were one time, though, he looked at me, are you crazy? I was 30 years old as a head coach at Butler, had 5 years, and we had some good success.
We were winning pretty good, and I left to go to Ball State as an assistant. And I remember I didn't ask him his advice. You know, it was one of those that made my own decision. And that was the one time I think he was like, what are you doing? You've been a head coach. You've had success. Why are you giving that up? Or,
you know, he never said you're crazy.
I don't know if he was disappointed or befuddled that, what are you doing that for? You know, you're your own boss. You know, you put yourself in a position where you're being successful. Why? I always sense that. And I'm not sure. I didn't become a head coach again while he was. I was at IU, and I got the head coaching job. And that's why I tried to sell my dad on without asking his advice. By making this move, hopefully it's going to help me get a better job. I took the head job at Ball State, and he was in the nursing home and not very good. So I'm not sure he probably ever knew the truth. But that was the kind of advice that I remember him, do something you love. And the other thing, he did say, be your own boss. And that's, I think, why when I was a head coach and I gave that up, it's like, what are you doing? You're your own boss and you're doing well. But he didn't really understand the
way the stepladder
the coaching profession.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope to be remembered by?
You got to say, I hope to be remembered as being a good husband, good father, good grandfather, and worked hard at my... Mm-hmm. You know, I've never been too much to worry about, well, where does he rank as a coach, or... You know, is he, how good is he, how bad is he? Hey, you go to work every day and you work your butt off. And coaching, you know, there's a lot of factors goes into wins and losses and records and all that stuff. So I've never gotten too hung up on that. Never had too many goals of how many games you want to win or be looked back on. I think that's, if you do the other things right, then you're going to end up being pretty successful, I'd say.
Bill Lynch, my Papa Bill, the man who is all about the people. Although he will go down in history as arguably one of the greatest coaches in the state of Indiana, it is his humility and integrity that make him the wonderful man that he is. The man who has shaped so many, including, but not limited to, the 26 members of his own family. He is one who will be remembered by his outstanding character above all else in the years to come.
Now that's a good story right there.
We were at Kevin's high school graduation. So he's the fourth one that graduated. And we're sitting in the upper deck there at Emmons. I'm not sure why we're in the upper deck, but we're in the upper deck at Emmons. And I was at Bloomington, and you were kind of back and forth because we promised Kevin he would be able to graduate from the Hilton. But we're sitting there, and he walks across that stage, and I got the biggest elbow in my side. And I looked over at her, and she said, "I'm officially retired." So she's been retired since the day Kevin graduated. Then she went on the board of trustees at QVC.